Do you want to connect with clinicians, partners, investors, and experts who can speed up your scale-up in health tech? Our hands-on mentorship, guidance, and the program's suite of benefits can help you navigate the path to commercialization like the insider you'll soon be. To apply to be a Rosenman Innovator, go to rosenmaninstitute.org. Applications are open through April 12th.
I think we still have a stigma surrounding mental illness, and understanding the circuitry and the biological substrates of depression, I think, will help us move past that. Mm-hmm. And I think this technology, both with the deep brain stimulation and the more non-invasive methods, will allow us really to understand depression more specifically and help us move past some of those older views of psychiatric illness.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Dr. Catherine Skangas. Catherine is a psychiatrist and neuroscientist whose work focuses on interventional psychiatry, which aims to treat psychiatric illness by modulating activity in neural circuits. She's an assistant professor here in the UCSF Department of Psychiatry and co-director of the Transcranial Magnetic Stimulation and Neuromodulation Clinic at UCSF. Catherine believes that mapping and understanding the brain at the circuit level is a vital step to improving our understanding of mental illness and how to treat it. She discusses the possibility of using neuro-based devices to deliver personalized depression treatment by stimulating specific neural circuits. Here's our conversation. Well, welcome. Thank you for joining me today, Catherine. I've been looking forward to get you, you know, come participating in our Rosenman Symposium. We were supposed to have you last year, and then the COVID happened. And I was like, oh, I was really disappointed. But I thought, you know, there's a different way for us to get you exposed to a lot of our community who will find what you're working on is really interesting.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So one thing that I was thinking maybe you can, you know, tell us a little bit more, you know, there's, I think you are, at least based on what I read, is like you call yourself interventional psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. And I think, at least for me, that's a new term. I always think psychiatrist is psychiatrist. What is interventional psychiatrist and how is it different?
Okay. Yeah, so interventional psychiatry takes a little bit of a different approach towards treating psychiatric conditions. Traditional therapy is psychotherapy or medications, but we're increasingly realizing that psychiatric conditions, just like neurological disorders, are based on neural circuits and dysfunction across these neural circuits. So interventional psychiatry tries to treat psychiatric illness by modulating or altering activity across these circuits to restore their healthy functioning. So we use techniques such as transcranial magnetic stimulation, deep brain stimulation, and, you know, some additional newer treatments as well, and as our focus for our therapy.
And you're also the director of the TMS and the neuromodulation here at UCSF.
Yes.
Which, tell us more, like, for that particular department, what is the goal and what is trying to accomplish?
Sure. So this is both a clinical and research program in the TMS and neuromodulation clinic. And we do two main therapies. One is transcranial magnetic stimulation. And that's a non-invasive procedure where we use a magnetic field, pulses of a magnetic field to activate parts of the brain that are involved in depression. And this is a focal treatment that has shown to be quite successful in many people who haven't responded to traditional therapies like medications and psychotherapy. We also treat some patients with obsessive compulsive disorder with deep brain stimulation in that clinic, which is an approved treatment for patients who have the most severe form of OCD. And then outside of our clinical practice, we are doing research to try to develop better forms of these modulatory treatments. We particularly do image-guided TMS. So this is where we collect MRI before a treatment so we can really make sure we're targeting the very precise part of someone's neural circuitry that we want to target. We aim for one region, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And so this enables us to really target that in each individual. And we are doing EEG to look for biomarkers or neural signatures of depression states. We know that depression is not one disease. You know, it's defined by collections of symptoms. So one person's depression looks very different from another person's depression. And so we are using these imaging and EEG techniques to try to find different types of depression that can help us predict what types of treatment are better for each patient and predict whether a treatment will be successful earlier than the traditional 8 weeks that you have to wait to see if a psychiatric treatment is helpful.
When you say depression has a different, everybody's mm-hmm. different, is that it's really personalized or is more like there's a different, so many different categories? And then we just mm-hmm. understand that particular category based on what part of the brain that's maybe is affected by it? Or is it completely just each person is different?
I think there are definitely certain categories of depression. We know there's some similarities to depression across patients. But because it's defined by a collection of symptoms and, you know, it's just sort of a subjective disorder, like do you experience difficulties in sleep, you know, loss of energy, poor concentration. Some patients have a different subset of symptoms than another patient. And so, you know, they might need very different types of treatments. So if we can understand the relationship between one set of symptoms and the neural activity that underlies those symptoms, then we can start to test ahead of time. Is this signature present? Then they should have this type of modulatory treatment over the DLPFC. Do they have this other type of circuit dysfunction? Then we need to target a different brain area. And so we think that over time, we'll be able to know much more ahead of time about someone's disorder so that we can develop very targeted treatments that are personalized to their depression dysfunction.
So some of the patients that you have that went through this, the neuromodulation, mm-hmm. and because they have not responded to medication, probably therapy, mm-hmm. is this still, when you do this sort of treatment, do they still need to have those treatment as well in addition to, and then is it fixed permanently or is this something that they have to go through throughout their life?
Well, we recommend that people who are on medication and then receive TMS stay on their current medications. So they aren't able to come off of those medications with the TMS, but it seems to help a large number of patients who haven't responded well to those other medications. So it kind of acts like a boost mm-hmm. to their current best therapy. We see many people have a response that lasts many months, and then they might have to come back 6 months, a year later to have another short course of treatment, of TMS treatment.
And at what point... I feel like the mental health, being the psychiatrist, probably you know where the line is, like somebody's really clinically depressed or somebody just normally depressed. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, somebody who expressed it louder, you know, it's mm-hmm. almost like, you know, sky's falling. Somebody can be more depressed than other. And how mm-hmm. do you differentiate somebody like that? And then who can get that treatment to get just mm-hmm. change their mood like that?
Yeah. I think that really understanding how someone's feeling takes time. And I think that's sort of what you learn over the course of a psychiatry residency and then far beyond into your practice. And it's both a combination about what people say and their affect and their behavior, reports from family, changes in their daily life that they've made because of their illness. So I think gradually you can build up a picture of how someone's life has changed. And, you know, different people experience depression in different ways. It affects people more strongly than others. And all of those things matter. It's not really important if, you know, one patient I think is, you know, deserves more, you know, is worse than another, right? It's really patient centered, how they believe they're doing and how it's affected their life. With TMS right now, it's reserved for patients who have failed other therapies. So they've have to have tried several different medications. They have to have tried, psychotherapy. And then if none of those things work, then they're a candidate to try TMS. One of the nice things about TMS is it has really few side effects. So a lot of medications, you know, act throughout the brain and also, you know, other areas of the body, and you can, have side effects from that. And TMS is, you know, one nice thing is you don't have very many of those side effects.
If there's not many side effects, why wouldn't that be as the first line treatment? Why does the patient have to go through all the different doses that's not working and has a side effect?
Yeah, well, one reason is that it's new still. You know, it hasn't been around for 20 years. And so we're still investigating it as a therapy. We know it works, but it's not yet the standard practice. And maybe that will change. And there is research that shows if people are less depressed, TMS responds better, or they respond better to TMS. Mm-hmm. So it may change. It may be more of an option for what patients would like to receive first.
Do you think, because it's a new technology and then have psychiatrists is being trained that, you know, this is a different way of training the future psychiatrists to think about technology as an opportunity instead of just medication?
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. You can see that the residents are really interested in learning interventional psychiatry techniques. We have residents come through our clinic and do rotations. There's an interventional psychiatry interest group at UCSF. So there's a lot of interest in people coming through the training programs now. So I think that will be true in the future. And I think we'll have other options for neuromodulation that are on the horizon, and there will be more targeted and more specific versions of TMS that allow us to target more precisely the different brain structures.
Do you think more and more school of psychiatry throughout the country are approaching it this way, more like interventional, like what you're trying to do here, or even UCSF is pretty small subset of that new school's idea?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say it's one thing over another. I think all the different schools of therapy have their place. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to have the different treatment options and groups of psychiatry within psychiatry work together. TMS alone is not going to be effective if patients aren't engaged in therapy and behavioral activation and changing their daily behaviors. So it's only a tool that's sort of in the context of greater changes. Mm-hmm. So I think UCSF is encouraging, and it has such a collaborative environment across departments and within the psychiatry department that enables additional research to be moving forward in this area. But it's only one area. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping medtech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
So, I mean, you mentioned earlier about understanding the patient, interacting mm-hmm. with them to understand what they are going through better. Mm-hmm. And with the technology these days, there's a lot of CBT app, right? Mm-hmm. Like the AI. And what do you think of that? Because, you know, it's so hard. Access is one that's really mm-hmm. challenging. And, you know, I think doing the robot, the AI, the hope is to increase access to mm-hmm. that kind of resources. And how helpful do you think, or how do you measure that is working?
Yeah. No, I think there are two sides to the story. I think we can even see that during the pandemic, where more people needed help. And we were able to move to do our appointments through Zoom, and this enabled more people to have access to mental health care. But it's different. We don't see the patient in the office. It's harder to see body language. So I think they're both good parts to that type of treatment and, you know, negative aspects about it as well. The same, I think, is true with CBT. It's different sitting down with a therapist and sort of drawing things out on a paper and setting goals than it is working with a computer program. Although, it's very easy to use the computer programs and do it every day, it does miss that personal interaction, I think. So I think, again, they both have their place, and probably a combination is the ideal, where you meet less frequently with a provider and able to supplement with the computerized versions of these therapy programs. I do think that as we go forward, we'll have the ability to collect much more information. We need these huge and large data sets to help us identify better biomarkers of severe disease. And so I think a lot of these, electronic sources of information are going to end up being quite helpful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to know that mm-hmm. a bunch of people are collecting all this data right now.
Yeah.
Doing their, mm-hmm. Tell us some of the new technology, the research that you're working on. I know mm-hmm. I met you when you're presenting your study with one of the patients at UCSF. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So this is a study which we call the Presidio study, where we're trying to develop new forms of deep brain stimulation to treat neuropsychiatric illness. And this research was started through a DARPA-funded project that led by Eddie Chang, with that same goal to develop new neurotechnology for neuropsychiatric illness. And so I came to UCSF to work on that project and to get involved with these tremendous researchers, Eddie and Andrew Crystal, who shared that goal. And one of the first steps is finding biomarkers of depression and these disorders. And so I came to work precisely on that topic. And out of that research evolved two clinical trials, one in depression and one in pain. So I'm now leading with others the depression trial. And so what we do in this trial is we implant electrodes, very thin wires, across the cortical limbic circuits, which we know are involved in depression. And we deliver brief pulses of electrical neuromodulation across these circuits. And we find locations that improve patient symptoms. And like I said, depression is different in different people. And so we do this so we can identify personalized sites in the brain that are dysfunctional in one given patient. We also, during that time, look for signatures, neural signatures of a patient's depression circuitry. So gaining this information then allows us to implant a chronic treatment. We use the NeuroPace device. This is a commonly used device in patients with epilepsy. And so we're able to use that device to deliver personalized depression treatment. And in this treatment, we continuously record neural activity as a patient goes along their normal day. And when their depression circuits go awry, the device automatically delivers this stimulation. It's undetectable to the patient, but over time, each stimulation burst is undetectable, but over time, the effect builds up, even as short as 15 minutes, and the patient is able to engage much more successfully in their lives. So we don't know if this is successful yet for every patient. We've done it in one patient, and it's been very beneficial for her. That gives us encouragement about the approach, but we need to test it in additional patients and using randomized controlled methods.
Yeah, so that I think when the last time we spoke, I think that you're about to do another study on her because they have to remove the device and then put it back in. Must be really hard when it works and you take it out, you'd be like, how do you justify? It's like, oh, can I just keep it on?
Well, actually, we took it out and then we put it back just in the locations that were good for her. And then now she's living with it. So we didn't have to take it out. Yeah. So it should last, our estimate based on the dose we're giving her, it should last maybe 10 years or more.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's great.
Yeah. So she's doing fantastic, actually. She moved out of her parents' home for the first time in 5 years. She started volunteering, is looking towards her future, going back to school. So it made a big difference in her life, which is very rewarding.
Yeah, no, because I spoke briefly with her too. I thought that was really brave of her when she first started, but it paid off.
It's been such a collaborative effort with the patient. You know, we really rely on them to provide a lot of very detailed input and keep up with depression reporting multiple times a day over long periods. And so, you know, we've really worked together to tailor the treatment for her.
That's great. Does that mean the patients still have to go through different kind of therapy or that kind of the implant, the neuromodulation kind of take care of itself without other things?
Right now it's taking care of itself without additional information. We still ask her to fill out depression scales on an iPad a couple times a day. To help us keep track of the relationship between her symptoms and the number of therapies she's getting per day. But for a while, you know, there was a long period where we were working to modify the different stimulation parameters and identify the detection algorithms of the device to be able to reliably identify that biomarker. So there's a lot of fine tuning of the device parameters to get it to work in this integrated way.
So even right now, are you able to kind of tweak the modulation right now as we speak, or is it something that's once implanted, then that was it, and then every time you want to tweak, you have to go in again?
No, we can implant. We can tweak it anytime. We aren't tweaking it right now because it's working for her, but it's implanted in her brain. You can't see it. There are no wires down her neck. It's just totally implanted. And then we have this wand that we can hold over the device. And then it can sort of download the data. And then we can view it on a computer. So I can log into the system and say, oh, how many detections did she have today? How many therapies did she have? And then I can talk with her and she can say, you know, I'm not sleeping very well at night. And then we may turn down the number of therapies delivered or the intensity of the stimulation. So we can have her come in and make modifications whenever necessary.
That's really, really cool. Is there a plan for doing another patient? I mean, N-of-1 is really working really great. I'm sure you get a lot of requests.
There are plans. So we've now done it, done the procedure in one patient, like you said. We have approval to carry this out in 12 patients. We have a couple candidates. We put a little bit of a pause on during COVID, so it slowed things down a little. It's hard to have people come into the hospital for prolonged periods of time, and it does require a lot of staff to be involved in the trial. But we anticipate getting started with our next patient relatively soon.
That's exciting. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to hear that result. I mean, 12, that's a big jump, but mm-hmm. I'm so glad for the one patient that you had that things are looking good for her. Yeah. My last question, I know, like, just what do you see the future, like, with all the technology? And I mean, there's a lot more interest and attention being paid to mental health in our country now. Mm-hmm. And what do you see, you know, I feel like there's a lot of exciting things that are happening.
Yeah, so I'm hoping this research will translate to more options for mental health treatment and within depression. You know, we've learned a lot of just basic principles about circuits by doing this study. So we've mapped out the circuitry. We understand the effects of stimulation on depression symptoms. We know we can modulate symptoms in a dose-dependent manner, and we know these effects are durable. And we know they're state-dependent, meaning if you stimulate when someone's in one mood state, it can have a different effect than if they're in another mood state. And so all of these findings, we hope to be able to translate now into non-invasive treatments that don't require a brain surgery. The brain surgeries are, I think, really critical for patients who have very severe depression, who don't respond to any other treatments. But we now want to translate that into non-invasive techniques that can reach more people and be available to everyone. I think we still have a stigma surrounding mental illness, and understanding the circuitry and the biological substrates of depression, I think, will help us move past that. Mm-hmm. And I think this technology, both with the deep brain stimulation and the more non-invasive methods, will allow us really to understand depression more specifically and help us move past some of those older views of psychiatric illness.
I felt the brain is finding its moment right now. And I think it'll be really exciting to see the development in the next few years, and we all can benefit from it. Well, thank you so much. It's been so fun to learn about what you're working on. I think you're doing all really exciting stuff here at UCSF.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really nice to talk with you.
Okay, great. Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, our content writer, Kelly Muscat, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.